Well, you know, unfortunately, we see a lot of shows like Lock Up and so forth that portray a certain subset of what goes on in prison. And, you know, that's real. But there's a lot of things that are not necessarily shown all the time that are really positive. You know, I had no experience with prison, never been in a prison before I stepped in San Quentin the first time. So I had the same sort of perception that most people do. San Quentin is a very ominous looking place, and it has death row. It has all the death row inmates for California. So I thought, you know, this is a sort of a place where people go to serve out their time. And, you know, a lot of these guys are beyond any type of help. Mm-hmm. That was my perception. And for most people, I think that's the case. What happened for me, even the first time I went in and started talking to the guys, and I did a presentation to a small class about entrepreneurship, and I did not have any idea that the response that I would get would be so amazing and deep. These guys were just thirsting for education, thirsting for a conversation about things that they were so interested in. The guys wanted to start businesses. They wanted to learn. And it really immediately changed my perception of that. And what we try to do a lot now is bring people in. I bring in portfolio CEOs. I bring in people that I know, other investors and whatnot. We have demo days in there where the guys pitch their ideas and they're phenomenal. And every person that walks out has a different perception. And that person becomes an ambassador of what we're doing.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. If you haven't checked it out yet, our Sunday Quiver is like a behind-the-scenes DVD for the themes of the week's interviews. We recommend articles, links to books written by our guests, TED Talks, and much more. So that way you don't have to scramble to find all the things that we reference during an episode. And when our first book comes out in August, that's where we'll be announcing all the pre-order bonuses. So visit unmistakablecreative.com/newsletter to learn more. Today's episode is brought to you by our friends at HostGator. And as you know, HostGator is perfect for anyone who's looking to build a website or start a personal brand. They provide 24/7 live support via phone, chat, and email, which you've heard from previous customers is incredibly reliable. They provide one-click WordPress installs, and they have an easy-to-use website builder if you're not too tech-savvy. And if you've recently joined HostGator, send us your receipt and your domain name, and we'll share your website and what you do with the thousands of people who listen to our show for free. Just email your receipt and a link to your domain to srini@unmistakablemedia.com. Chris, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Glad to be here.
So, you know, I came across your story on the TED.com website that said you're a venture capitalist who is teaching incarcerated people how to write code. And I was immediately drawn to it. So I tweeted you right away and said, you know what, I really would love to help you spread the message of this story. You know, I've been starting the show a little bit differently than I have in the past. And I want to start with a question that I've asked a handful of people that I found has been really informative. And that is, what is the most important lesson that you learned while growing up or during childhood from a parent, teacher, or coach that has influenced and shaped the work that you've ended up doing and kind of how you've lived your life today?
I think the most important thing, you know, I was a competitive athlete early on, competitive runner, and part of it is just a couple things. One is that if I wasn't particularly blessed with huge amount of talent. Mm-hmm. So part of it is, how can you let efficient sort of training and approach and just potentially outwork to accomplish what you want to do and try to improve? So I think that is something that I've sort of had this go for it mentality all along, regardless of what I'm doing, that I'm really just completely immersed in it and trying to win. And I think that really comes from that sort of competitive background of having to not be as particularly as talented, but realizing that work could overcome some of that. So, and also really being inspired by what I'm doing, you know, doing something that I really enjoy. And fortunately for me, early on, I was hired by Reebok, you know, early in the company when it was just sort of nascent, and went through the almost legendary growth during the 80s of, and, you know, in 1988, overcoming Nike the number one shoe company in the world. That didn't last very long, but mm-hmm. just going through that huge growth and also at the same time being a competitive runner and being that environment, I never felt like I was working. It was just the most inspiring time where I was working with and competing with guys that I really enjoy being around and always have those competitive juices going. And I've really tried to continue that throughout my career. I think the other analogy as well is, since I was a long distance runner, as we approach business, we hear this sort of overused phrase of, you know, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. You know, I definitely live that physically. So as I approach business, and as we start talking about TLM, it's the same thing about, you know, this is a long-term, lifelong project that we're involved in, realizing that, you know, we're going to have bumps in the road, but if we maintain that long-term vision, that, you know, we'll accomplish what we want to do. So I think those, that experience and those analogies early on for me have helped me throughout my career.
You know, I think that it's interesting that you had the foresight to realize that doing work that inspired you was so important at an early age. And I feel like a lot of young people miss that. I know I certainly did, because I remember my entire filter for how I would choose was literally based on, you know, what the paycheck was. And I was in early in the Silicon Valley days, and I told this story before. I met a guy in a coffee shop about probably 15 years ago, and his name is Oren Hoffman. You may have heard of him.
Sure.
Yeah. And I very distinctly remember, and I'm almost positive it was him, because I remember he told me, he said, I don't have a lot of money. I can't pay you anything really, but you'll learn a ton. And I chose not to work at that job. And I always think, wow, how many potential opportunities and how much room for growth did I miss out on? Yeah. And so I guess the question is, you know, and I've asked this to people in various forms, why do you think that at a young age, we're not aware of the importance of finding meaning in our work?
I think it's sort of, you know, we're exposed to a tradition, and certainly the American way before, so to speak, was, you know, grow up, get an education, get a job, and, you know, get married, support a family. If you think about sort of the traditions that we have been exposed to throughout, we're starting to see those traditions changing. And I came from a pretty traditional family. I was the youngest of three boys, and I dropped out of college. I ended up graduating, but I dropped out of college sort of midterm to explore things I wanted to do. One of those things, I just had this fascination with open water sailing. So I took off a year and I sailed to Hawaii, sailed around, and you know, had that whole immersive experience. And I came back and my parents sort of wiped their brow and said, oh, we got that out of his system. And then I took another year and I went to Alta, Utah and got completely immersed in skiing. Uh-huh. Because those are things that were really important to me. And I'm like, if I don't do it now, I'll never be able to do it. So I think that's sort of, for me, were how I've sort of carried out throughout my life, and not being irresponsible necessarily, but doing things that I was really passionate about. So break that tradition was really sort of difficult for me and my family. Mm-hmm. They're happy that, you know, I came back to the fold. But I think we're seeing that now today, where obviously, especially when we're talking about technology, we see, you know, Peter Thiel's idea of, you know, drop out of college and I'll fund you for your new idea, or the fact that you can be a great coder and not have a degree, or you can drop out and, you know, if you drop out of Harvard, you're guaranteed to be successful. It's right. You know, sort of tongue in cheek. But, you know, we're seeing those traditions starting to break, certainly as far as education and a pathway that certainly from my generation was very, very much a legacy and a tradition that when you did something unusual, as I did, you know, your family and your friends kind of like, oh, you know, he's going sideways. Yeah. You know, he's never going to come back. You know, I think it's only going to change more and more and more, I think, as things become more sort of a la carte in a sense. Yeah. I mean, the way we're consuming is more a la carte. We're just breaking traditions and breaking sort of packaged way we've lived previously, and it's only going to continue.
So, you know, as a surfer, I can completely appreciate what you're saying, because I have had a very similar experiences. And as you might imagine, coming from an Indian family, when you do something as crazy as that, they're like, you've lost your mind.
Yeah.
The question, I guess, is, do you think those kinds of immersive experiences where we get deeply absorbed in something, which, you know, on the surface appears to have absolutely nothing to do with our work, which, you know, in a million years, I would have never guessed, you know, all the work stuff I've done around surfing would lead to actually writing a book using surfing as a metaphor for life. So I'm just curious, do you think that those kinds of immersive experiences are necessary in order to find sort of the deeper meaning in our lives and sort of become, you know, who we're meant to be or who we're destined to be?
Yeah, I think so. Without getting too deep, I think just the idea of becoming immersive. I mean, when you start a company, you have to be totally immersed in what you're doing. So I think the same sort of mindset approach, you know, is that approach. So I think it translates, just a matter of how you approach things translates what you're doing and you know, how you're going to be successful in that. I think it really does help. And unless you have that experience, it doesn't matter if it's surfing or sailing or skiing. It's if that is something that you've embodied that you can sort of replicate in other situations, and certainly if you can replicate that in business, I think it really is beneficial. So if you've never had that experience of really sort of commitment, I mean, we talk a lot about, you know, I'm a venture capitalist, so it's like we want commitment from our CEOs and from our founders. But I think if you've never experienced true commitment, maybe you don't really know what that means.
Mm-hmm. So you told me about what you've learned about running and how running taught you about sort of this idea of a marathon. I'm curious what you've learned about business, human behavior, psychology, and people from the sailing experience and the skiing experience that you've applied to the work that you do today and the work that you've done throughout your career.
Well, I think part of it is certainly with sailing, you know, when I'm dating myself, but when I sailed to Hawaii, it was 1976, and there was nothing, there was no GPS. Uh-huh. So you know, we used navigational, celestial navigation, using a sextant to navigate. So you have to be very self-reliant there, you know, and I think that was really important. Again, friends and family thought I was crazy because, you know, you get out in the middle of the ocean and nobody knows where you are. So you literally lose contact from 100 miles out until you're 100 miles within your destination. So I think a lot of that is self-reliance and really dependency on other things that you have to learn. I mean, you know, to navigate is not an easy skill. So you have to learn that, and to hit a dot in the ocean takes a lot of sort of precision. So I think that's certainly something that I learned. I think from skiing, I learned that if I did it too long, I would enjoy it too much and I would never accomplish anything. So I cut it off at a year saying, this could last 20 years because it's too much fun. So I learned that, I guess.
So, you know, a lot of the traits that you're talking about that come from these sort of immersive activities like skiing, running, they don't strike me as the kinds of things that you could learn by sitting down and reading a book or, you know, attending a class where somebody teaches these sort of things. So, you know, for people listening who are running companies, working on creative projects, whatever it might be, I mean, how do you develop those kinds of skills? And, you know, what have you seen as the impact in the people that you've worked with and the founders that you've invested in and also everything you've done? Like, what kinds of impacts do those skills have going forward?
Well, again, I think it comes back to doing something that you really want to do. You know, it has to be something that's really ingrained and embedded in you know, your psyche and your motivation. Whether it's something that you really enjoy or something that you're trying to solve a problem. I don't think you can ever get to that level of commitment unless it's something that is really deep-seated inside of you and something that's really motivates you. So, you know, part of our job, because we're investors in early stage companies, is to try to identify that, try to sort of suss that out when we're talking to founders. Is this something that, you know, is that deep-seated in them? Is that something that they're really motivated about? Is it something they're really passionate about? And you know, again, it gets, those are sort of overused sometimes, but that's what we have to do, is be able to identify if this is someone or a group that is really dedicated and motivated, committed to that path that they've selected. And again, when we invest, we're talking about a relationship for us that's going to last 5, 7, potentially 10 years. Mm-hmm. So we have to understand that, you know, early on we spend a lot of time with our founders, because that's our job really as seed investors, is to really be very value add at that point. You know, as the company progresses, we have sort of less communication with them, because then it really becomes a sort of a growth dynamic. But regardless, we have a relationship for a long time. So I think we have to be on par with how we view things. And, you know, we are as sort of into what we're doing and as committed to our group of portfolio as they should be their company. So I think we have to be synced in how we look at things.
Yeah. You know, in addition to the sort of intrinsic motivation and drive that these people come to the table with, what have you seen as patterns in the people that have really just went out and achieved everything they've wanted to and been successful? And what have you seen as patterns in the ones that you kind of look at and thought, okay, you look back and realize you made a mistake on?
Yeah, I think part of it is people that are, you know, the way I have sort of an acronym I look at. It's, passion, presence, and perseverance. I look at those three sort of qualities. And those are important because, you know, we talked about passion already, but yeah, the perseverance piece is they have to be able to deal with a lot of things, obstacles in the way. And sometimes if you don't have a relationship with someone, you don't really know if they're going to be able to deal with that long term. Hopefully, as we do a lot, you know, we have a pretty decent network. So hopefully someone within our network knows that person or has worked with that person or something so that we can identify that. And the presence piece is that person someone that can effectively lead? Because when you're obviously you need presence to be able to pitch and for funding, you have to be able to be the front of a company, but you also have to be able to lead, and that presence is super important when you're talking about leading a company. So those type of traits we really look for, and good leaders are good listeners, and I think that's really a key for us also, that especially, as I said before, we're spending time with these young companies. We don't expect them to adopt everything that we suggest, but we also want to be able to have an exchange and good communication. So those leaders that are good communicators, that are very open and transparent with us, and that also will take suggestions and will be open to dialogue, I think those are the traits that really work. The ones that don't, it's interesting because we look at our portfolio constantly as far as evaluating where they sort of are on the success metric. And, you know, really, to the company, most of them are very good communicators, and I think that really helps. There's a few outliers, but for the most part, those are ones that we communicate very well with and consistently.
Mm-hmm. The perseverance piece, I can't help but ask about, just because, you know, we've seen so much in the media about things like founder depression and the psychological aspects of all of this. You know, I've had Jerry Colonna here, and we did a really interesting talk about, you know, so many of the things. And, you know, I think there's even an article on Inc. about the psychological price of entrepreneurship. So a couple of questions come from that. You mentioned the ability to navigate obstacles, and I've asked this in various forms to different people. Do you think that the ability to navigate obstacles and the resilience that is brought about by that is only something that you can get through the experience of going through something difficult? Or is that something that can be inherently, like, can people just be brought up with that naturally?
Boy, I don't know if I can answer that, effectively. I mean, I think if you've gone through it before, you know you can go through it again.
Yeah.
But I've seen people that are very young and experienced deal with it, deal with obstacles very well. Mm-hmm. I have to think that having a good support system really helps in that. But some are just, I think, inherently able to deal with it better than others. But certainly, if you've had experience with that, I mean, look, I've been through two downturns in my career, so it's like I know what it feels like to get beaten up. Mm-hmm. One thing is you look for signs for that, and also you, from experience, know how to deal with things that you probably in the past could have done more elegantly. So I think having experience certainly is beneficial, but I've seen, you know, young folks that are, you know, first-time entrepreneurs be stuck with something really difficult and be able to come through it very effectively. So, you know, I think it could be trained.
Yeah.
And it could be just something that some people have a better, better way of dealing with than others.
Yeah. I ask questions. That's the kind of question that I don't expect a concrete answer to, because I know there isn't one. It's always just interesting to hear the perspective that people have on it. And I think you brought up something that's really critically important, which is a support system. Like, I realize so much of what we do here, at our show and running our company, we couldn't do it without the team that's around us. And I think that's one of the most sort of underrated things. Like, you know, you've got this sort of hero mentality because somebody is always in the spotlight because we have these public presences. But you kind of, if you start to look at it, like behind every one of these people who's done something is an insanely talented team.
Well, that's it too. I mean, I have a great support system. I mean, my wife is probably my biggest support system. And I'm fortunate to have someone who like that, who is my wife, my business partner, and everything else wrapped into one. I think it's very unusual. But also just people around me that I can consider mentors to help me. It doesn't matter where you are sort of on the hierarchy of success, in a sense. You always need to have those exterior sort of external voices that you trust. It's Bill Campbell, who's legendary in Silicon Valley, just passed away. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was a mentor to Steve Jobs and the guys at Google and, you know, various other people that were at sort of the pinnacle of career, but they still needed that external voice. And I think that's really important. And we can't lose sight of that. So we try to be that for some of our young companies, but also, you know, I reach out to those that I trust in a somewhat of an inner circle for the same support.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's do this. I'd love to talk about where things go from working at Reebok to becoming a venture capitalist who teaches prisoners how to code. Mm-hmm.
It's just a natural progression.
Yeah, exactly. I'll tell you, when you say that, it makes me think of something I wrote on this post on Medium that has gotten quite popular. I said, after 700 interviews, I've noticed one pattern, and it's that straight and narrow paths very rarely lead to interesting destinations.
I like it.
So speaking of straight and narrow paths not leading to interesting destinations, and yours being incredibly interesting, how do you go from working at Reebok to being a venture capitalist who teaches prisoners how to code?
Yeah, so I left Reebok in the early 90s, and some guys that I was working with on a different project were putting something together that they called a online community and online yellow pages. And this is the days of Prodigy and CompuServe and early days of AOL. And it was fascinating to me because I went through this huge explosive growth with Reebok. We went from, when I joined the company, it was doing about 10 million in sales. When I left, we were doing about 4 billion in sales. So it's like that growth, you think, I'm never going to have that experience. Lightning's never going to hit twice for me. And then I saw the internet. And I thought, oh my God, this could be huge. So I got involved with these guys. It was called On Village, and worked with them. The company was sold about 2 years later to Superpages, and that sort of just struck me as my first experience in this nascent thing called the internet. And that was in 1995, 96. I worked for a while for a company called Money Mailer and helped them launch their online coupons. It was a direct mail house. And from there, I met a guy who we basically had very similar sort of enthusiasm and interest in the web. And, again, it was very nascent in commercialization of the web. But we started a company called Ad Auction, which was the first media exchange buying and selling media. And we launched that in 1997. And that was here in San Francisco. So that really sort of launched me into it. But, when I first got involved with On Village and sort of in the mid 90s, I had to do a lot of learning and understanding. And again, I think we were all at that point learning about what the internet could be. So that was the launch for me. And from then I've been involved in several companies, several acquisitions, and started angel investing in 1998 as I was developing Ad Auction. One of the first companies I invested in was a company called Omniture. And I met this guy, Josh James, a young guy out of BYU. And I met him here in San Francisco, and he really didn't know anybody. And we had lunch, and I was so struck by him. And he had all three P's right away. I knew right then. And I literally came back to my office. Beverly was working as a consultant for the company at the time, even before we were married. And I said, I met this guy. I'm going to invest in him. You need to invest in him too. And, you know, sort of long story is Omniture became a public company in 2006 and was very successful. So one of my very first investments became a very, you know, successful exit. And that really sort of, I was struck with the investment bug even then. So we, you know, I continued to angel invest, and about 6 years ago, we formalized our fund and launched Transmedia Capital, with a fairly narrow focus of digital media, commerce, and so forth. And it's expanded since then, but, we're on our second fund with Transmedia Capital. The fund one has done extraordinarily well. We have several quote unquote unicorns in the portfolio. So very knock on wood lucky that the timing of such coming out of 2008, 2009, coming out of the trough there, we were able to really take advantage of some great companies, some really great economics. Things were very, very frothy then, and those companies have done extremely well. But I really think that coming from an operational background has helped me and my partner as well. We both came from less traditional backgrounds to become venture capitalists, and I think that's really helped us a lot because we've had multiple companies. Some have worked, some haven't. We've raised a lot of money as entrepreneurs pitching VCs, so there's a lot of empathy across the table for those people that are coming to us for support. So that's really sort of an untraditional path, but it seemed to work for me.
So two questions from that. You mentioned Reebok going from, you know, what you saw in sales when you started to what you did, what it was doing when you left. And then of course, all these successful exits. I'm curious throughout this process, how you've maintained two things. One is the intrinsic motivation that you have for what you do. And two is momentum. And then of course the other is how this has all altered your perspective on wealth and money.
You know, I was fortunate to be in a successful situation early on. So I learned what freedom was early. And, you know, I'm not particularly interested in stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm more interested in doing things that I want to do. So I think success allows for freedom. And that's been the most important thing for me. It's less about, you know, acquiring things. It's more about the ability to do what I want to do. And, you know, that sort of leads in, you were asking the question of, you know, then how does it lead to teaching guys inside to code? Well, we had the sort of financial independence and also the wherewithal to start a program on our own dime and dictate how we wanted to do it without someone else telling us what to do. And, you know, we were we're working within the California Department of Corrections. And we started the program 6 years ago called The Last Mile. Mm-hmm. And that program, the initial curriculum was teaching entrepreneurship inside prison. But I when I went to Sacramento to get approval through the governor's office, when I went to finish the meeting and we went to the door to finish and I put my hand out, normally the handout is sort of like, okay, I want this from you. My handout was, I wanted to shake their hand and say, I'm looking for permission. So I think that was a little surprising to them because normally they're, you know, people are asking for financial support and whatnot. I wasn't looking for that. I was looking for their support to allow me to do what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And we were asking to do some things that were very unusual. Within the sort of the current legacy of how things were done. And one of those was allowing the guys in our program to be actively involved in social media, which means they would write and we'd publish what they write. Mm-hmm. So that was a little scary initially. And everything had to be approved through and sent to the administration for approval before we published it. But what happened was this transparency of what the guys were writing about their experiences and what they were dealing with and what their hopes and dreams were about really got a huge amount of response. I mean, if you go on Quora today and you look up some of the profiles of The Last Mile, they write very clearly and somewhat graphically about their experiences, and this amount of response that came back to the community was huge about, you know, my loved one's dealing with this, or I'm dealing with issues, and I'm what you said and how you get through this is helping me, and all these kind of things was really amazing. So that whole experience and transparency really was a huge positive, and we weren't really sure what that was going to be, but certainly now CDCR and the state has been hugely supportive. Now they are actually helping to support some of the growth within the program, but initially they were very concerned about that. We really used that momentum to do something that I wanted to do earlier on, but didn't have the sort of credibility and the confidence until I showed that we could have some successes to be able to propose this. But I proposed the idea that we would start a technology incubator inside San Quentin as an initial location where we teach coding. And we would also set up a joint venture where the guys inside who still had time to serve could actually do outsourced coding for private companies. So that was a pretty big ask. And unless I had, you know, some sort of credibility and results in the past, they probably wouldn't have gone for it. But right now, just to give you a sense of where we are, we're on our going to our third year of coding in San Quentin. We've expanded to other facilities. We should be in six by the end of the year, including at least one women's facility. We're teaching HTML, CSS, JavaScript, some Python, Adobe Suite design, and also WordPress. So these guys will come out with some solid proficiencies in those skills. It's a year-long program, two cohorts that they have to get through, but they will come out as employable, you know, I would say junior software engineers, but that's a huge step forward for many of these guys learning a trade. And within San Quentin, we have 22,000 square feet there that used to be the old print factory that we converted into this technology center where we'll have connectivity in there, not to the local machine where the guys are, but to the facility where we can do remote instruction and we can do work for private companies, as I said before. If people are used to, or are familiar with South of Market, Soma area, where there's a lot of sort of the lofty buildings and the old brick buildings, this has a lot of that feel to it. It's a high ceiling and big space. It probably would rent for like 80 bucks a foot in San Francisco. But it's a great location. We've had to do a lot of upgrades to it. But we look at this as being the sort of template for what we can take moving forward. We basically package our own curriculum that we want to license to other facilities. So the goal is to really get a foothold in California, launch those locations, and then take it out beyond that. And I look at, so 3, 4, 5 years from now, that this would be a national program that would be in many, many states that are teaching this employable skill, taking the dozens and hundreds that we would have in California to thousands of people that are graduating and become employable, and breaking that cycle of recidivism, which today nationally stands at about 60%. So, you know, 60% of the guys that are getting out, guys, men and women, are returning to prison. We want to reduce that. And, you know, obviously there's a huge cost savings there. So that's sort of the ultimate goal, sort of a long, long answer to that. But that's really where we want to be.
There's more on my conversation with Chris after this message from our sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by ctshirts.com. I love these guys. Charles Tirrett. I was actually one of their customers before they started sponsoring the show, and they're the best business casual in shirts you're going to find anywhere. All the fashion from their famous store on Jermyn Street in London has been made available online, and they're giving our listeners a huge savings. Charles Tirrett shirts are the most exquisitely tailored, crease-free shirts ever. British styled using only the softest, most comfortable fabrics. Tie or no tie, tucked or untucked, you'll look great. And if you order now, you'll get 3 shirts for just $99. That's 60% off, and all CT shirts come with a free delivery, a 6-month quality guarantee, and free returns. So just $99 gets you 3 amazing shirts right now. So visit www.ctshirts.com/creative. Again, that's www.ctshirts.com/creative. DesignCrowd.com, DesignCrowd.com, is a website that helps entrepreneurs and small businesses outsource or crowdsource custom logo, graphic, and web design from designers from around the world. They have over 500,000 designers from Sydney to San Francisco who are ready to help you with awesome custom design. Here's how it works. You visit DesignCrowd.com and you post a request describing the design you need, for example, a logo design. Then DesignCrowd will invite its 500,000 designers to respond. Within hours, you'll receive your first design, and over the course of 3 to 10 days, a typical project receives between 60 to 100 different designs from designers around the world. And then you get to pick the design that you like best and approve payment to your designer. And if you don't like the designs, you can go back to the crowd. And they're offering a $100 discount for Unmistakable Creative listeners. So visit designcrowd.com/creative or use the promo code creative. And last but not least, our friends at HostGator. As I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, HostGator is perfect if you're looking to start a personal brand or a website of any sort. And if you've recently joined HostGator, we'd love for you to send us your receipt and your domain name so that we can share your website name and what you do with our listeners for free. So just email your receipt and a link to your domain to srini@unmistakablemedia.com. Now, back to my conversation with Chris. Wow. And this is really why I wanted to have you on the show, because I had so many questions about this. I'm curious about two things. What were your own perceptions of the incarcerated prior to this, and how have they changed? And what misperceptions do you think that we on the outside world, based on what we consume in the media, have about all of this?
Well, you know, unfortunately, we see a lot of shows like Lock Up and so forth that portray a certain subset of what goes on in prison. And, you know, that's real. But there's a lot of things that are not necessarily shown all the time that are really positive. You know, I had no experience with prison, never been in a prison before I stepped in San Quentin the first time. So I had the same sort of perception that most people do. San Quentin is a very ominous looking place, and it has death row. It has all the death row inmates for California. So I thought, you know, this is a sort of a place where people go to serve out their time. And, you know, a lot of these guys are beyond any type of help. Mm-hmm. That was my perception. And for most people, I think that's the case. What happened for me, even the first time I went in and started talking to the guys, and I did a presentation to a small class about entrepreneurship, and I did not have any idea that the response that I would get would be so amazing and deep. These guys were just thirsting for education, thirsting for a conversation about things that they were so interested in. The guys wanted to start businesses. They wanted to learn. And it really immediately changed my perception of that. And what we try to do a lot now is bring people in. I bring in portfolio CEOs. I bring in people that I know, other investors and whatnot. We have demo days in there where the guys pitch their ideas, and they're phenomenal. And every person that walks out has a different perception, and that person becomes an ambassador of what we're doing. So I've never really sort of hard pitched what we're doing. I just say, give me 2 hours, come in and see what you think. And they walk out and they become evangelists, and many of them continue to help volunteer and so forth. So it's become very viral in that respect. And you know, media has come in since then. You know, sort of the word got out a little bit. So we've been covered by many media sources, CNN, CBS, you know, Today Show, USA Today, Wall Street Journal. They've all sort of covered what we're doing. And that's really helped promote this idea of, you know, people can rebuild their personal brands. They can change. They can be productive members of society. They don't all have to just return to prison. And even guys with violent crimes. I mean, within our program, majority of the guys are in there for violent crimes. Mm-hmm. Many of the guys are there as early people. You know, they do this their crimes and whatnot as teenagers. Mm-hmm. We have a guy right now that is interning for us at our venture firm. He was incarcerated at 16 years old, served 22 years, basically grew up in prison. Wow. And he's been out, he got out March 4th, and he's interning for us, and he's one of the hardest working guys you'll meet. And he's, think about all the things that you have to learn and how technology changed, but he never even drove a car before. Uh-huh. So, you know, that those are the type of transitions that we deal with a lot, but that he is not that different from most of the guys in our program.
Have you seen situations that have disappointed you when it comes to this, where people come out and they don't come out with the outcomes? And of course, you know, in addition to what you just told me, are there outcomes that have just stunned the hell of you, out of you? And are there portfolio companies that you guys have invested in that have been started by any of these people?
We're in the midst of doing two guys are doing nonprofits that that we're helping with right now. We fortunately, knock on wood, we haven't had anybody reoffend. So we have zero recidivism in our graduates. I'll tell you what, though, it's a very rigorous program, and we make the guys, if they want to be in the program, they have to sign an oath of commitment. It's a zero tolerance program, which means that if they have an infraction inside, they're immediately terminated from the program. Mm-hmm. And that carries over. That oath of commitment basically says that while you're inside, if you do anything detrimental to the program, you're immediately terminated from the program. But also, after you are released, your commitment is to be part of this community for life. And these guys have really lived that. Vinny, who I just mentioned, who got out recently, the day that he got out, we got him a phone, and I think he got at least a dozen phone calls from guys in the program supporting him. Guys came over and visited him. It's amazing that just this, no one wants to fail. And I think that's part of being in a community where recidivism is so high that you could say, you know, I could do something and I'll take my chances. These guys consciously think about, if I do something wrong, I'm letting down all my brothers. You know, they really think about that. So that community aspect is critically important.
So in terms of getting sort of the rest of the workforce and the rest of the companies in the world who are hiring, how to embrace this and, you know, look past the fact that these guys are incarcerated, that they've served time. And what has that process been like? Like changing the narrative that people have about these people that don't necessarily know, you know, what you guys have been able to achieve.
Yeah, it's, well, I did go out early on and ask a few favors, to be honest with you, with companies in our portfolio saying, you know, would you be open to provide an internship for a graduate? And basically the expectation is that the internship is a paid internship. It's between $15 and $20 an hour, and it's a commitment of 4 months. Mm-hmm. So I didn't think it was a huge ask. But what turned out was that the guys that got out were their work ethic, their attitude, their commitment, just the way they're approaching things was so positive that they went in the workplace and they earned respect right away. The other thing was, I talked about earlier about transparency. Yeah. I wanted everyone in the company to know that there wasn't anything they couldn't ask them. They could ask them about their background, their experience in prison, anything. So I didn't want people to walk around on eggshells thinking, oh, I can't step in an area that might be sensitive. There's no area that's sensitive. You can be able to ask these guys anything. And I think that really set people at ease. Uh-huh. But it was just the idea that these guys were so motivated, they're working so hard, and this entitlement that sort of pervades Silicon Valley a little bit, I think about, you know, I'm owed something. Mm-hmm. You know, you could look at somebody and say, one of our graduates, and if you're having a bad day, you think, that guy's had a really bad life so far, right? And look at how hard and motivated they're working. It really served as an inspiration. Since then, you know, we've had multiple, obviously, placements there. And, you know, the profile and the size of the company we're dealing with is growing. And this awareness is growing as well. Mark Zuckerberg came and visited our program in October of last year, and we had a lot of discussions about how that will change culture potentially in companies like Facebook. So we've had other CEOs that I can't talk about yet because we haven't sort of launched a program, mm-hmm. but brands of people listening would be very familiar with that we're talking about placement programs within those companies. So I really am confident within the next year or so, you're going to see a change in dynamic and companies that are of high profile that are allowing and being receptive to hiring those that may have come from a, you know, criminal background.
Well, this has been really cool. And I am really, you know, honored that you took the time to join us, and I you know, really thrilled to be able to help spread the message to our audience. So I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all our interviews with the Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think it's, you know, being very unique and very true to oneself, that they're trying to sort of follow their own path and take their own, and not necessarily take other people's suggestion on how they should be, to truly be their own self. And I, as we've talked about before, try to live that, but, you know, you may not necessarily take a conventional path, but you really have to follow what is in your heart, so to speak. And that really makes, I think, people genuine, authentic, and unmistakable.
Awesome. Well, like I said, I really, really appreciate you taking the time to join us and share your story and your insights with our listeners. I think they're going to really enjoy this.
I appreciate it very much.
Yeah. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Next time on The Unmistakable Creative.
You look at the way other people have succeeded and you have to make a decision. I can either follow what they did and try to outdo them, or I can pick a completely different path and be the greatest at that. And I remember looking at my brother and my sister and being like, okay, well, you know, my thing isn't going to be academics. It's not going to be athletics. So I'm going to go into marketing, because that's what you do when you're not good at athletics and academics.
Author Sally Hogshead joins us to talk about creating work that's impossible to resist.